Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Amanda Littman, who is the co-founder of a group called Run for Something. And we are going to have a hopeful segment, even if it kills me. Then we're going to be joined by Sabrina Tolukter, the director of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress, to talk about the right's newest and perhaps most brazen attack on reproductive freedom in the form of a ludicrous decision handed down by a Trump judge down in Texas. But first, I just want to note what an absolutely dizzying couple of weeks we've had in American politics. Just the ups and downs, the sheer ups and downs have been wild, right? The oscillations, it's enough to give you whiplash. So first, Democrats turned out in huge, I think it's fair to say, historic numbers for an off-year judicial election in Wisconsin and changed the balance of that state's highest court in a landslide, right? So the Wisconsin Supreme Court now has a liberal, a quote, liberal majority. And this is expected to have really far-reaching impacts on the state's near total abortion ban, which was passed long before Roe v. Wade and automatically snapped back in when Roe v. Wade was overturned. And it's going to have a massive impact on the state's really wildly gerrymandered election maps and possibly on the 2024 presidential election, because this is one of those states where, you know, Republicans control the legislature, and you know, maybe they'll end up with the doctrine that they may have the final say on who becomes president. How egregiously gerrymandered is this map that they've been working with in Wisconsin? Well, think of this: in 2022, Democrat Tony Evers won the governorship with 51% of the vote. Democrat Josh Call won the attorney general's race with 51% of the vote. So you have these two statewide races, and Republicans won 64 of the state's 99 House seats. Right? They also won 6 out of 8 of the state's congressional seats. So it's basically a 50-50 vote, and they get 3/4 of the congressional seats and 2/3 of the state house seats. So winning control of the state Supreme Court is huge. At the same time, right, the same time this was going on, the GOP picked up a state house seat in the Badger State in a special election. So that gives Republicans now in that heavily gerrymandered legislature a supermajority. And they are threatening to use that supermajority to impeach Democratic officials, including perhaps the governor and this new Supreme Court justice. So can't just have good things. Meanwhile, down in North Carolina, one formerly pro-choice Democratic state lawmaker flipped to the GOP. And this seemed to be like a, I don't want to go too far over my skis. I haven't followed this story that closely, but it seems like it was out of pique. Like she had some conflicts with her colleagues and decided to take her ball and go join a fascist movement. So now her decision to defect to the Republicans gives that legislature, which is also heavily gerrymandered, a veto-proof supermajority. This matters for a bunch of reasons, not least of which is that North Carolina and Florida are the two states that were widely seen as the last places in the South for Southern women to obtain abortions. And now both states are moving to ban or severely restrict the procedure. In Florida, they're considering it, and it's going to pass, a six-week abortion ban. Most women do not know they're pregnant in time to make arrangements before 6 weeks. Because, right, you got to know you're pregnant, and then get an appointment somewhere. So it's not like you even have 6 weeks. Of course, in Tennessee, two young Black Democrats were expelled from the state house for protesting their Republican colleagues' inaction on guns in the wake of yet another mass shooting in a school. Their protest was joined by a white Democrat who was not expelled, right? Pretty obvious. So that's the bad there, but this resulted in what seems to be some national backlash that Republicans did not expect. And the governor, the Republican governor of Tennessee, voiced his support for some, you know, modest but significant gun safety reforms. So that did not work out well for them. Republican lawmakers in Missouri voted to defund their state's library system entirely in retaliation for two library associations challenging a law that banned certain books deemed to be too racy by right-wingers, right? They were like, oh, you want to challenge our authority? Well, we're going to just defund your whole library system. One Texas county is considering doing the exact same thing after a judge ordered that it return banned books to the shelves. They're going to maybe just get rid of the library entirely. Of course, we will talk about that crazy abortion ruling handed down in Texas in our second segment. So much going on. You know, there's that Chinese blessing that is also a curse, although it isn't really a Chinese proverb at all. It's apocryphal, but it says, may you live in interesting times. And I mean, that we do. On that note, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. Welcome back. You know, while it's often obscured by kind of fuzzy references to polarization, we are right now at a point in this country where the GOP is basically being forced to adhere to unpopular position by its radicalized and propagandized base, which is obsessed with performative culture war bullshit on the one hand, and deep-pocketed donors demanding more tax cuts and deregulation on the other, right? So these are two unpopular poles. And so they have to stick to these key, you know, demands from their constituents, which means that they're unable to develop a popular agenda without, you know, getting creamed in a Republican primary. So Republicans in states and localities that they control are increasingly rejecting, you know, pluralistic democracy in favor of something that looks like self-governance, but has a playing field that's so rigged in their favor that they're insulated from public opinion. You are, of course, familiar with this story. And on the other side of that are a small d Democratic coalition that's rightly fearful of what they are seeing, and has really been energized to get out and vote since Trump won that first surprising victory in the Electoral College, despite losing the popular vote by a big margin in 2016. So immediately after that election shocked the Democratic coalition, a bunch of new organizations, which were dubbed resistance groups by friends and foe alike, were set up almost overnight in many cases. In many cases, these groups were established by people who had not been political pros in the past. They had not been involved in advocacy groups, but they were freaked out by the prospect of Donald Trump breaking things in the White House for 4 years and had some organizing experience or relevant experience. I sat down, tried to figure out what they could do to save the country. My next guest was one of those people, although she had been a staffer for Hillary Clinton's campaign. Amanda Litman is the co-founder and co-executive director of Run for Something. It's a group that encourages younger candidates, in broadly speaking, to run for office, mostly at the state and local levels, and helps them win and get onto the, you know, Democratic bench or whatever you want to call it for higher office down the road. Amanda, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. I interviewed Amanda for a piece I wrote for The Nation back in 2017, and I saw her quoted this week in a piece by Paul Waldman, my old editor, and Greg Sargent for The Washington Post. I want to just quote a little bit from that piece. "The reactionary turn underway in many red states is beginning to shape a new generation of young Democratic officials, many of whom will one day be the party's leaders. In these red states, young Democrats are entering local politics and developing public presences in the response to the far-right culture warring unleashed by GOP majorities." Amanda, how are younger Democratic candidates who you're meeting around the country, how might they be kind of different attitudinally from their peers who came of age politically at a time when there was, you know, more bipartisanship, a lot less vitriol, a lot more embrace of small d democracy, even in Republican circles? I know everyone is different, but can you draw any kind of like general observations about this generational dynamic?
Yeah, I think that perhaps the most succinct way of putting this is that the young people who have come up in politics, especially post 2016, but more broadly, I think you could generally say since 2008, you know, people who are like me, maybe 2008 was their first election voting. Since then, they know bullshit when they see it. They understand that in particular, the modern day Republican Party is not on the level. They're not operating in good faith. They are not good faith negotiators. They're not interested in co-governance. You know, I think back to when Mitch McConnell said straight up, "We want, our number one goal is to make Barack Obama a one-term president." It wasn't cut taxes. It wasn't elect judges. It wasn't policy. It was politics. And we have seen that really, you know, in years before, but ever since, they have said the quiet part out loud. They are in it for power and not even really for what they want to do with that power. So the modern day elected officials and the young people who have come up in politics since then, who've been elected, the millennials and now the Gen Zers who are taking office, are not afraid to push for their values and are not interested in some quote unquote civility or politeness when the other side does not play by the same rules, and when it's not just some abstract other person whose life is at stake. You know, so many of the young people coming up who are running and winning are people of color, are young women, are young queer people, are people who know folks from those communities that are being marginalized, who are their loved ones. This is not an abstraction for them. It is deeply personal. And that means they're not afraid to take the fight to the other side, which I think is a really powerful place to be operating from.
Yeah, one of the so-called Tennessee Three, the lawmakers who faced expulsion for protesting the legislature's refusal to do anything on gun safety in the wake of yet another horrific school shooting, Justin Pearson, he saw his mentor gunned down just last December. Then a very old friend of his was shot and killed, and then his body was set ablaze in January, right before all of this happened. So it's really a personal issue. This dynamic seems to be especially potent in red states because of that sense of threat. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. It's not just something happening over there to someone else. It's something happening to us. To our friends, our communities. So there's no patience and no time to wait for someone else to fight in our behalf.
Yeah, yeah. One of my current heroes right now is Nebraska State Senator Michaela Kavanaugh. She's young. I don't know how old she is exactly, but she's a millennial. And she's been filibustering every bill in the Nebraska State Senate over a proposed bill that would make most gender-affirming care illegal for people under 19 years of age for, I think it's been going on for 6 weeks now, 7 weeks now. We talked about it when she had been going at it for about a month. She's been getting a ton of national media attention, as have the Tennessee Three. Is there a lesson in there that maybe earlier generations of Democrats could learn in terms of how you break through the media noise by standing up against these forces that seem indomitable in these states?
100%. And I think Senator Kavanaugh in Nebraska is being joined in no small part by Senators Megan Hunt and John Day, both of whom are Run for Something alum we worked with in previous cycles. Megan was the first openly bi member of the Nebraska State Senate, John the first openly gay. For Megan, you know, for both of them and for Senator Kavanaugh as well, this is personal. You know, Senator Megan has a trans kid. It's her son who's being harmed by this kind of legislation. And we see this in Tennessee too. And in other states, like, it is really powerful to fight. And I think the key takeaway for Democrats writ large is it matters to elect good people who give a shit, even in states we cannot win or control the majority. Having someone in the minority who's willing to stand up does make a difference. And I like national Democrats are so quick to write off a state like Nebraska or Tennessee as somewhere, we're never going to flip it. So why invest now? There's other more important things. And the answer is because we see why this matters. And we're never going to flip it if we don't start doing the work now.
And I mean, Georgia, right? I mean, you know, it was not long ago that everybody was writing off Georgia. Oh, you can't win in Georgia. Right. Why even bother investing there? And, So these things, it takes, I don't know why, it takes hitting them over the head so many times before they understand that you need to really do these investments at the lower levels early on and consistently. You can't parachute in every 4 years and think that you're going to build a coalition that can change these states. Amanda, who else is inspiring you right now? Can you name a couple of people who ran for something and should now be on our radar?
Oh, there's so many. It's like asking me to pick my favorite. I will say, just because today it's in the news right now, the Missouri House Republicans are passing legislation to basically pull funding from the entire state's public library system. It's going after book bans in another route. I am thrilled by some of the Run for Something alum we have in the Missouri State House, Carrie Engle, Ann Mackey, Ashley Onne, Emily Weber, and a number of others who are just pushing back with every possible tool in their arsenal. Down in Florida, I'm always rooting for Representative Anna Eskamani, who is fighting as hard as she can against the abortion ban and some anti-union legislation, along with Minority Leader Fentrese Driscoll and a number of others we've got in the chamber. Down in Texas, I'm keeping an eye on Representative James Tallarico, Aaron Zwiener, and a number of others who are pushing hard against book bans and the whitewashing of history in that state. But one of the best parts of this job is I get to be inspired every day by someone new taking on a new fight. I wish they got a chance to stop fighting and take a breather every once in a while, but yeah. I'm really lucky to get to work with them and to see the kind of impact they can make.
Now, not all of the groups that I wrote about in 2017 are still around, but some of them, like Run for Something, Indivisible, Swing Left, others have, I think, grown and I don't know if this is the right word, but kind of matured, certainly have more funding than they did back then. And I think that they have helped Democrats become more aggressive in pushing back on some of the culture war issues by simply modeling that this is something that you can do in a way that they, you know, mainstream Democrats or national Democrats used to shy away from these issues. How much of the, I hate to even call it the resistance at this point, has become such a cliche. How much of that infrastructure built up in 2017 and 2018 endures today? And how has your organization evolved?
Well, I think for us, we were never really about Trump. And that's what's been sort of the secret sauce to our not just sustained, but explosive growth over the last 6 years. And when we first started, we'd ask people, well, why are you thinking about running? You know, sign up, tell us your name, your info, and give us a couple sentences on why. And of the folks who ultimately went through that process and got on the ballot, only 3% named Trump as part of their rationale for running. it wasn't about him. It was about problems they wanted to solve in their community. It was about representative leadership. It was about, you know, reflective democracy, seeing leaders who reflect the communities they serve. And I think that is why we've been able to grow so much and why we've been able to stay strong and move forward, because it's about sustainable power. We're really lucky that so many of the folks that started up their organizations with us back in 2017 are still around, some in the same form, some in others. Others still have completed their work and folded, which takes just as much work and courage as staying alive. But it is really cool to get to see this ecosystem grow and change and adapt to the changing political environment.
Amanda, before I let you go, I want to ask you a tangential question. It's not quite in your organizational, you know, whatever. But I'm a Gen Xer, and I'm accustomed to younger voters like disappointing every time. There's always like, oh, they're going to be excited, and then they don't show up and vote. And that seems to have shifted. Mm-hmm. Certainly since the 2018 midterms. The best predictor of someone voting is whether they voted in past elections. How much of the electoral energy within the Democratic coalition, and especially among young people that we've seen pretty much since off year elections in 2017, do you think may be permanent? And are we past the days where we should just assume the worst and assume that young people aren't going to turn out unless there's some extraordinary factors like Barack Obama running?
Oh, I think if anything, we've seen that young people can be counted on to show up and to vote Democrat. I remember the young voters who came out in record numbers in 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020, no longer so young.
Yeah, that's right.
They're now 20-somethings and 30-somethings who are pot committed to the Democratic Party, even when they're sometimes mad at it, even when they're sometimes disappointed in it.
Yeah.
They are completely eyes open, aware of what the alternative is, and we don't like it. They've also had a chance to build voting as a habit. But as you said, you know, people who voted in the last election are the ones most likely to vote in the next one. At this point, we've got a couple cycles under our belt of young people showing up consistently. So I think it's just the beginning of the millennials and Zoomers taking charge as the most potent force in the electoral space. And it's going to be fun to see the GOP die, just basically the ability to connect to young people.
I mean, I think it's a really important point that the GOP's lurch towards authoritarianism is not evidence of strength. It's evidence of weakness. Mm-hmm. And they know that on some level, at least. Amanda Lippman, I believe we are about out of time, and I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then be right back to talk about this Texas judge's rogue abortion ruling with Sabrina Telukdur, who is the director of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Over the horizon, she's smooth sailing these concrete seas. Now she headed east down the boulevard, Duval. Sure, said I like the way, said I like the way. Sail your ship now, let me be your cargo. I won't wear you down, no honey, I won't wear you down. And we are back. I'm joined now by Sabrina Telukdur. Sabrina is the director of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Sabrina, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. You know, I was reading a piece this morning about how some abortion advocates who are working in red states are experiencing burnout as a result of the right's like relentless and often creative assaults on reproductive rights. The latest salvo in that comes from a judge appointed by Donald Trump to a federal court in Texas, a court where right-wing legal groups and attorneys general have engaged in what's known as venue shopping to bring unlikely cases before this very judge, Matthew Kaczmarek. And is that how you pronounce his name?
Kaczmarek? Yes, Kaczmarek. Mm-hmm.
And what he did was shocking, but not surprising, given his history. Kaczmarek overturned the FDA's approval of the most commonly used abortion drug, mifepristone, which was issued over 2 decades ago, right? This drug has been approved for decades. It has been proven extremely safe. And he just, we'll get into his rationale. Sabrina, you wrote of the decision, and I quote, "Personal politics seem to inform the type of language the judge uses throughout his order." What did you mean by that?
Well, it's no secret that Judge Kaczmarek's ideology leans exceptionally conservative and that he has pledged to anti-abortion movements in the past. And I want to know what you said, that there's a lot of forum shopping going on. The plaintiffs of this case are Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, and they incorporated their organization specifically in a remote little town called Amarillo, Texas, in order to have their case specifically heard in front of Judge Kaczmarek. And the ruling from the district court order is littered with scientific inaccuracies, misogynist language towards women, so many things that indicate that the law around the approval for drug safety in the United States has been politicized, and that the judge's ideology has served as a replacement for what Americans rely on to make sure that the drugs they're taking are safe.
I'm seeing some media outlets that normally tend to be very cautious in avoiding using language that might be perceived as partisan. And they are describing this decision in blunt terms. I think a reporter for the New York Times likened it to a judicial coup. Can you help our listeners understand what the ramifications of this ruling would be if it were to stand?
Of course. And I think the reason why media outlets are being so clear on how radical and unprecedented this decision is because this case really highlights the politicization of the judiciary and the politicization of drug safety in the United States. The implications of this case for a judge to just try to overrule the FDA safety determination and to take off, to take a drug off the market with the stroke of his pen is unprecedented. And what this decision amounts to is an invitation to any politician, to any judge, to any state actor or federal actor, and it allows them to come in and try to take something off the market that Americans rely on. And also, this is the first time that a judge has overruled the safety determinations of a drug that the FDA has previously approved of. And what this signals is that the FDA and drug manufacturers, all of their work will be threatened by potential litigation. And so that has a direct impact on patients. Patients won't know what drugs are available to them. Physicians will not know what they can and can't prescribe, and drug manufacturers will be discouraged from investing in clinical trials and things that allow for generics and for medication that Americans rely on.
There is a 6-year statute for challenging drug approvals for the FDA. Again, this approval was handed down 23 years ago? Over 20 years ago.
Correct.
How did he get around that?
So Judge Kaczmarek used a kind of legal tool known as the reopener doctrine, and it's extremely flawed the way in which he applied it. What he did was say that, well, even though it was filed in the year 2000, because the mifepristone was revisited in 2016 at later times, that allows us to reopen this ruling and see what happened. However, that's not how the reopener doctrine is supposed to be used at all. And, very recently, the Fifth Circuit actually ruled on this issue as well. As of now, the Fifth Circuit has said that Judge Kaczmarek's overruling of Mifepristone's approval from the year 2000 was incorrect. However, the Fifth Circuit, and primarily because of statute of limitations. However, they said that the 2016, 2019, 2021, and 2023 reapprovals and reconsiderations of Mifepristone and the safeguards around Mifepristone were available to discuss and to rule on.
All right. let's just make sure that our listeners can understand what we're talking about here, because this gets a little complex. So first of all, before we even talk about that, there was another federal judge in Washington state who issued a dueling decision that required the FDA to keep the abortion drugs on the market in 17 states that had Democratic attorneys general. Okay, so that happened shortly after Kaczmarek's decision came out. And then, as Sabrina mentioned, on Wednesday night, we're recording this on Thursday, the very conservative Fifth Circuit struck down some of Kaczmarek's ruling and let the rest stand. By the way, that was a 2-1 decision, with both judges who ordered some new restrictions having been appointed by Donald Trump. So the Fifth Circuit said they approved Kaczmarek's order barring these drugs from being sent in the mail, and they undid a FDA finding that these drugs could be given up until 10 weeks, and now it's until 7 weeks. Let me ask you this.
It's laughable.
It's so confusing. So, all right. So, I guess, what does this all mean? What does all of this mean?
That's a really great question. Something that we're all trying to figure out across the country. So why don't we do this? Why don't we just break down each thing step by step? So last week, Judge Kaczmarek issued a ruling that basically said that Mifepristone from the year 2000 on is unlawful. And he issued something called a stay, which puts things on pause until the Fifth Circuit makes a decision. 20 minutes after Judge Kaczmarek made his ruling, another federal judge in Washington state issued an order saying that Mifepristone and access to Mifepristone cannot be changed in 17 states and the District of Columbia. Then immediately, the Department of Justice filed basically an appeal to the Fifth Circuit yesterday. Really very late last night, early this morning, I'm still not sure, but around a few hours ago, the Fifth Circuit released its own decision. And what the Fifth Circuit did is that it blocked a major portion of Judge Kaczmarek's outrageous April 7th decision. It said that making Mifepristone unlawful from the year 2000 is not correct. However, Mifepristone, as it has been implemented from the year 2016 onwards, it rolls back the FDA safeguards and approvals all the way back to 2016. And there are a few practical implications. There are four practical implications of this. The first, as you noted, is that Mifepristone will only be approved for use up until 7 weeks in pregnancy, as opposed to 10 weeks, that's what it was in 2023. Second, Mifepristone will be barred sending it to be mailed, going through the mail. And this was really important because it allowed people to end their pregnancies fully in the comfort and privacy of their homes. Third, only doctors, as opposed to some other qualified medical professionals, will be allowed to prescribe the medication. And lastly, it goes back to an old requirement to have 3 in-person doctor visits before you're allowed to get Mifepristone.
Yeah, it's all crazy. And I think that the point that I want to highlight here is that you have this completely wackadoodle decision out of Texas, but the Fifth Circuit also asserted that the judicial branch has a right to overrule the FDA and the scientifically informed guidance issued by the FDA. And that's, I think, equally bonkers. And that's the thing, that it's like they're just seizing this power to say, no, we're not scientists, but we went to church and we're just going to tell you what you can and can't have. I want to note I'm going to take a step back because I just wanted to highlight one important fact about Kaczmarek's ruling. At its heart is a claim that studies, he said plural studies, show that 14% of women and girls reported not getting enough information about, quote, side effects to make an informed choice. This is in his ruling. And here he wrote, and I'll quote his decision, 83% of women report that chemical abortion changed them, and 77% of those women reported a negative change. So this is really central to his ruling. And I just want to point out that according to the New Republic, these, quote, studies are an analysis of 54 anonymous posts on an anti-choice website called Abortion Changes You. So basically, this is it, what he's saying in a federal court decision. He's citing this bonkers anti-choice propaganda. Legal expert Adam Unikowski, who is a conservative, he wrote on his Substack, and I quote, "This is roughly like reporting a statistic that 83% of people are fans of Judge Kaczmarek without mentioning that the entire sample consisted of posters on Judge Kaczmarek fanclub.com." It's absolutely nutty. So, okay, both sides can appeal to the Supreme Court. That is, both sides can appeal the Fifth Circuit's ruling to the Supreme Court. Is there any reason to think that it won't be decided by the Supreme Court? You've got this split decision, right?
Well, the Department of Justice actually filed an emergency application to the Supreme Court for the case to be heard about an hour ago.
Okay, all right. So I'm a little bit behind the news. What do you think might lay ahead? Are you comfortable handicapping the decision's chances of surviving in that, you know, Trump-packed court?
Well, we hope that the Supreme Court justices rely on legal precedent and view this case not as, you know, one particular drug in question, but really about whether or not the Constitution allows a judge to interfere with the congressionally mandated authority of a federal agency. That's really what the heart of this case is. Whether or not judicial opinion can be substituted for expert medical determinations when the Constitution says, well, judges are supposed to be judges under Article 3, and the Constitution says that federal agencies are supposed to operate in a certain way and have authorities to do a certain way.
Sabrina, I'm gonna disagree with you a little bit there. I think that this Supreme Court has proven time and time again that it does not care one whit about judicial precedent. And the thing that I would hope for, the thing that I would rest my hope for, is that there is a sense of the need to preserve the legitimacy of the court. That is the constraining factor, I think, right now. And one thing I worry about is that you have, so this is a dynamic that I'm kind of aware of. You have judges like Kaczmarek issuing these truly like wackadoodle rulings. And then you have this very partisan Supreme Court struggling to prove its legitimacy. And it can shoot down a ruling like this on a technicality and then use that decision to argue that the court is conservative, but not partisan. The court is ruling according to their good faith interpretations of the law and the Constitution. And they're not just issuing decisions based on whatever outcome the conservative movement wants to see. And the press may buy that. And this is precisely what happened with a zany lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act a couple of years ago, right? Bunch of red state attorneys general came up with this specious legal argument that the ACA should be overturned. They got it in front of a Federalist Society judge who is known for ruling against Democratic policies, just a very similar situation. That judge, Reed O'Connor, was also in Texas. The Fifth Circuit affirmed his decision in part. Then it went to the Supreme Court and they upheld this ACA in a 7-2 vote based on the plaintiff's lack of standing. So it's very similar, and then they get to turn around and say, look, we're not, you know, activists. We're not right-wing activists. We're doing this all according to the law. And look, we we upheld the ACA, and now maybe we'll have a similar thing. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I think that if the Supreme Court hopes to regain a shred of its reputation after such cruel and ungrounded decisions, it needs to ensure that the FDA's expert judgment is allowed to stay intact and overturn the lower court's decisions. Because as you know, the American people deserve a fair and just legal system, not one that's just made up of politicians hiding in robes. And whatever the final word is when it comes to the approval of mifepristone in the United States, these decisions have laid bare the politicization of our courts. And that's something that we have to address as advocates, as American people, that it's time for meaningful court reform at every level, including the Supreme Court.
Yes, yes, exactly right. Sabrina Tolukder, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I do believe we're out of time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd also like to thank Sabrina Tolukder and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Mastodon at Joshua Holland. I'm also now on, what is this one? Spoutable, which seems very Twitter-like. I don't know. Seems good interface. So you can follow me over at Spoutable at Joshua Hall. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. And let's start it like this, son. Rolling with this one and that one. Pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16. And running up in gates and doing hits for high stakes. Making my way on fire skates. No question I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question I would flow off and try to get the dough off. Sticking up right boys on ball court. My life got no better. Same damn low sweater. Times is rough and tough like leather. Figured out I went the wrong route. So I got with a sick tight click and went on.